Hi, folks. Just before we start today's podcast, I just want to remind listeners that we are doing some live shows now on for our members. So if you're registered with us, if you're a supporter over on patreon.com/tortoiseshack, we will be doing some regular live shows with interesting guests. You'll be able to log in, you'll receive your link, you enter your PIN, and you'll be able to come in, contribute, ask questions, participate. And we hope everybody will enjoy this over the course of this lockdown that we're all enduring. So that's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Look, I'm not going to lie, it helps us keep the mics on if you guys help us out. We're all struggling at the moment, and we hope this might be a way to give back and maybe help us keep going. Talk to y'all soon.
Welcome to Reboot Republic Podcast, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. And we are in a crisis mode situation, which is unprecedented. We're joined today by, delighted to be joined by Dr. Gabrielle Colleran from the Irish, Vice President of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. Gabrielle, it's delighted to join you. Sorry about that. Baby is pulling out of me while I'm doing this, so I'm slightly distracted. But I am your host, Rory Hearn, and joined, as always, by my co-host and alter ego, who fortunately we're not together, but Tony, we're surviving just about. Tony Groves. Tony, how are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm just so glad I have no children under the age of 10.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to try and do anything with this idea of working from home with children under the age of 5 is just, it's bonkers and nonsense. But we'll try and see how we get on. Gabrielle, you know, there's a lot of things going on around the moment. Obviously, a lot of, you know, it's a traumatizing time for a lot of people who are losing loved ones in particular. But, you know, there's a lot of people. Assessment of where we're at right now.
Oh, I guess now we're probably, are we 7 weeks into this new reality, new way of living, which is so challenging for all of us. It's most challenging for people who have relatives and loved ones who have COVID-19 and who have sadly passed away. But for everybody, you know, our lives have changed, lost their jobs, are suddenly unemployed, but still have the same expenditure in terms of, you know, mortgage and things like that. And so positives in how people have really put quality, you know, the number of neighbours that have, you know, left scones, left brownies on the doorstep for myself and Kevin, because they know we're both, you know, from the hospitals, which is extremely nice. Everybody's helping out, bringing groceries, doing, you know, all those things. So I feel like those things are really good for the soul. When I look at the hospitals, I'm just really impressed at how flexible and innovative and committed our doctors, our nurses, all our health and social care professionals have been. I mean, when we look at, you know, trying to change how we provide care and change the service, it can take years to change care pathways and negotiate how things are going to be done. And what we've seen with COVID-19 is that overnight, in the space of a couple of days, we have drastically changed lots of things about how we work. And many of those changes would be things that could have taken years otherwise. And some of them are really good for patients. So say, because of the mitigation measures to slow the spread of COVID-19, we've really had to try to decrease the footfall on the hospitals for elective, for non-urgent but important work. So the hospitals are providing all the care for COVID-19 patients that need admission and that need ICU care. And all the other things like heart attacks, strokes, bowel obstruction, you know, all those acute emergencies are still coming. But a lot of the outpatient work has shifted from clinics where people are coming into the hospital and seeing people in outpatients to quite a lot of things being done by virtual clinics on whether it's Zoom or GoToMeeting or some alternative platform. While there are drawbacks to doing virtual clinics as opposed to doing things in person, for a lot of things, it's actually been very effective and a really positive patient experience. You know, say for yourself, Rory, now, if you had an outpatient appointment 3 months ago, you could be a couple of hours waiting in the hospital. You'd have had to take the day off work. And, you know, your appointment might take 15 or 20 minutes, but it would have taken your whole day and, you know, cost you a lot in terms of having gone to it. So from a patient perspective, the clinics that can be done virtually, we need to look at how we integrate that into our care. It's a massive help to someone who is working at home or has childcare issues or has, you know, an elderly relative that they're the care for or a child with additional needs, if they can have their appointment virtually, which pause, we have to really look at the things that we've changed for COVID, the ones that are changes that really work for patients and that are good ones and that are efficient and effective. We have to integrate those, that we don't just go, we're going back to how we did things, because we should be going forward and integrating.
Yeah. No, and there's a question that a lot of people are asking, and you know, I can hear that, you know, and I have spent days waiting with kids for, you know, and all those, you know, the, you know, major health issues that are not being seen, that there's this idea of not just a second wave of COVID, but, you know, a third wave of people who are putting off being seen, been treated, been diagnosed with COVID, and how is the, is, could we be doing better on that, or could we be doing more?
Oh, absolutely. So when I'm talking to colleagues, in nearly everyone has some urgent emergency presentation that is, so say in kids, their parents are so worried about the risk of them getting COVID if they bring them to hospital that they're keeping them at home. I think, Rory, one of the things is that patients are very conscious that we're all in this together and that the GPs are flat out doing all the additional work for COVID, and you know, they don't want to be bothering, you know, sudden visual loss of things where you've had an attempt. It's so much better when people come into us like they normally would, straight away into the ED where we can address it. So, you know, in the IHCA, every opportunity we get in the media, we're talking about this to try and reassure people that, you know, yes, you know, there is a concentration of COVID-19 in the hospitals because patients that need admission in ICU care are coming to us, but we're putting a lot of work into appropriate PPE, washing our hands regularly, trying to minimise the risk that we'll spread it from home. It'd be missed of me to say that there's no risk of getting COVID if you come into hospitals, but in reality, you know, there's COVID in our communities. When you go to Super Value, Aldi or Lidl, you're also getting it, and it's so important that people come. So that's one. So I'm really worried about that, Rory, and then I'm also really worried that our waiting lists were appalling when they started. You know, we had long lists in Europe, and you know, while we're doing a lot of virtual clinics, like I'm a radiologist, there isn't a virtual way to do radiology. You have to physically have a radiographer take the x-ray, you have to have a consultant or a sonographer do the ultrasound. So, you know, our important but non-urgent work, a lot of that has been on hold now for 7 weeks, so those lists have monumentally grown. And whenever we start to slightly relax the measures, whether it's the 5th of May or the 20th of May or the 10th of June, you won't be able to just go back to working the way you normally worked. And if you think of our hospitals, you know, many of them are old, the waiting rooms are small, the corridors are small.
Yes.
So we're going to have to try to social distance. And the only way we can really do that is space out the appointments, because our waiting rooms are so small. And before, I mean, you know, Temple Street, you know, fabulous staff, great team, bursting at the seams. You know, we really need that new hospital. But impossible to social distance in our waiting rooms with more than two or three family in there, you know?
I remember I was in, the Ioneer Hospital with my daughter there last year. We were waiting probably, I'd say, 6-7 hours. And in that main atrium area.
Coming through this, how do we tackle the immediate urgent backlog of the work that hasn't happened because of necessary COVID measures in the past 7 weeks, but also we're already in such a serious situation where we can't go back to having the waiting room packed, having 15 minutes between each appointment, and having, you know, like, say, look, I'm up for doing a Saturday outpatient list. Have we funding for, you know, the admin person to check people in, you know, who's a really important part of our team? Have we funding for the radiographers? And remember, we've, you know, a lot of our teams are already understaffed. We've, you know, we've a lot of radiographer vacancies. We're understaffed from a radiologist point of view. So you're asking the same group of people who are on a really tight call roster to take on more additional work. And you know the way, there's a limit to how much people can physically do before they burn out.
But absolutely.
I don't see a way out of this unless we really, you know, throughout this, one of the things, Rory, like you mentioned earlier when we were chatting offline, you know, parents who are trying to juggle childcare and working. So we've seen, you know, parents now who both work in healthcare where their creche is closed, trying to stagger one parent going in first, the other parent coming in later, and so doing work late into the evening. That kind of flexibility, we have to try to hold on to that and build in it a way that supports the healthcare workers and also supports the service so that we can expand it out. I guess my worry is that traditionally what we see is that there's a willingness to outsource work to the NTPF and to pay a premium for that. But isn't a willingness to pay, you know, a decent overtime rate for a radiographer who's taking on an extra shift at the weekend on top of doing their on call. And that's something I feel quite strongly about, that we should be putting the money into extended days, additional lists in our public hospitals, and not just always outsourcing to the private sector through the NTPF, you know?
Because the government have said politically that they're all in favour of doing it, and they would do it yesterday if it wasn't for the public health advice that they've got.
Yeah, and again, they haven't really been transferred. Like, they sort of talk about the National Public Health Emergency Team as if somehow, if they had to do it, it must be absolutely true.
Yeah.
I think we should have more sight, really, of those discussions. Like, there's great people on that. I know some of them, but, you know, yeah. In a group where you have the same group making decisions, you're always at risk that you'll just group norm and start agreeing with people that you respect. Like, we really need to have the 10th man going, hold on, guys, are we sure about this? Let's just go the opposite direction for a second. And I wonder if they have somebody in that function of going, hold on, let's, you know.
Gabriel, you've been advocating for this for a long time, and we've talked about the fact that pre-COVID we already had huge waiting lists, we already had problems that were considered, you know, all-time lows for parts of our health service, and you've also said that parts of the private health service we're effectively been able to cherry pick things, and we spoke about how, you know, good health policy is good housing policy is good, is good, all of these policies all match. But Sláinte Care was missing from this puzzle all the way along. It was said, it was used as this thing held out there on the horizon. But what we've seen now is Sláinte Care kind of on steroids. Is it going to fly along now, do you think?
Well, I guess, Tony, first I'd say that I don't at all think that this is Sláinte Care on steroids, because essentially what's happened is we've rented the private hospitals, but we haven't been providing a normal service. So to me, like, the success of Sláinte Care would be no patient with any condition in this country waiting longer than 6 weeks to be seen and assessed and treated. So, you know, this is wartime medicine providing a COVID service. And, you know, I guess what I would say, Tony, is like, policy is a matter for the government, but it's doctors that actually deliver the care. And to me, you know, when we were in a great economic situation earlier this year, we were way behind on Sláinte Care deadlines. So it has consistently felt to me that, like, the politicians across all the parties have used Sláinte Care as this umbrella panacea that gives them a get out of jail card for actually delivering healthcare reform. So however it's funded, I want to work in a system where no matter who you are, wherever you live in the country, you have access to high quality healthcare for everything you need within 6 weeks, so that access to care isn't impacting your outcome negatively. Now, I'm very open about the fact that I don't believe that copying the NHS, which has a load of problems. I mean, the COVID mortality in the UK ICUs is 50%. It's only 25% here in Ireland. So there's lots of things that we're doing better than they're doing there. We don't need to copy the things that don't work. I'm much more in favour of a universal health insurance model like we see in a lot of other European countries, where, you know, people who are, you know, below an income threshold get it paid for by the state. People like me that are currently paying private health insurance, who can afford to pay into it, but everybody has that access. I mean, if you look in Sweden, if you're in there, they have a UHRI type system. If you're waiting more than 3 months in the, you know, in the public system, with UHI, you're automatically allowed to go to the private hospitals with it. So, like, that's a situation where, you know, wherever you live in Dublin, whether you're homeless or whether you live in Blackrock, you know, if your CT hasn't happened within 3 months, you can go to the Beacon or you can go to the Blackrock clinic for it. So I feel like the NHS type Sláinte Care model is still very much like a bureaucratic model, where somebody in a department, like, without being disrespectful, but like a pen pusher who imagines what it's like to live her healthcare, is telling patients where they have to go and what they have to do. Whereas a UHI type model, where the, you know, the money follows the patient and the patient has choices about where they go, and where the private sector is regulated by the state, and where patients have options to use it where the public sector isn't, you know, performing as it should do, that to me is a model that's much more patient-centered and has much more control with patients. I mean, I don't know if either of you read John Crown's article in the Sunday Business Post last week, but I would agree with an awful lot of what John says in that, which is, you know, when we come out of this, we have to look at, you know, what worked really well. Well, our doctors, our nurses, our health and social care professionals were amazing in how people stepped up, were really flexible, changed care pathways, did so many things so quickly to make this work for people. But, you know, what was bad in this, you know, our capacity was a huge issue. The fact that the prospectus report, you know, was gathering dust since 2009. If we had doubled our beds like that had recommended by 2020, would we have been under such pressure to go into such a severe lockdown with the impact that has had on children who can't go to school right now and are missing seeing their friends, with the economic impact that has had for families where people have lost their jobs? I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that the fact that our ICU capacity was at the bottom of Europe along with the UK meant that we had to be very aggressive with our social distancing, with our, you know, efforts to try and stop the virus from going through the community as quickly as possible, because we didn't have the ICU capacity to handle a peak. Now, there's no health system in the world that would have an ICU capacity to handle unmitigated transmission through the community. But the fact that we were so low to start made this a very scary possibility before we started to implement the measures that have worked really well. But those measures have all come at a really high societal cost and at a really high mental health cost. So coming out of this, whatever policy, whatever's embraced, it has to go from policy to implementation. And that has to mean more beds, more doctors, and it has to mean the waiting lists no longer being accepted. Like, I just don't accept that any child that needs my input should be waiting longer than 6 weeks for it. I just don't accept that. I think it's fundamentally wrong. And it's how our system is designed. I mean, John Crown put it really well. Like, when you give a fixed budget to a hospital for the year and you say you have to make this last, if the demand goes up, the only way to make those things match is to do less work and have the waiting list grow. And that mentality is ingrained in some aspects of our services, and that's no good for patients. And if we keep funding that way, and Sláinte Care doesn't address that at all, you know, so doctors really want to work in systems that work for patients. And like, I'm a trainer in Temple Street, and we've the most amazing SBRs coming through in radiology, and then they go off to America and the UK and Canada for their fellowships. And, you know, for them to want to come back, you know, they're going to want to know that when there's a kid that needs to see them, that they can just see them, that it's not just such a fight. Like, you know, I was kind of exhausted at the end of February before this started, and, you know, really going, God, the waiting list, like, this just has to happen. And now, like, the 7 weeks that this, what this has done to our waiting list because of what it has meant for the cancelled outpatients, it's actually really hard. Like, it's like, you know, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? But, like, sometimes you're like, God, I've eaten so much elephant. How
a herd of elephants at this stage.
Yeah, you know, and I feel like I'm the whole time eating elephant. I really want to, you know, the elephant behind me and just be doing my job, delivering really good care. Like, we shouldn't have to be fighting so much to, you know, the policy end of things sorted. And I guess, you know, it can feel a lot, Tony, like, that's for some people, that health is something where it's just unfixable and intractable, and also maybe an opportunity for them personally to further their careers by having small wins. And we have to, like, put that mentality behind us and go, right, you know, we're a small country, you know, the landmass isn't massive, you know, let's just look at this, look at what people need, listen to patients, and then actually design the service to meet the need and the capacity. And we have to end this way of saying you have this amount of money and it doesn't matter what the demand is, because that just leads to waiting lists. And, you know, there are plenty of countries that just don't have this. Like, we you know, instead of being so obsessed with the NHS, like certain Irish politicians are, like, look to the European countries that have UHI and that have systems that work. Like, the government looked at this before. Like, in fairness, I'm not a fan of James Riley, but he was actually a fan of UHI. And I can't see how, when we're going to be in a recession after this and there wasn't the financial backing for Sláinte Care, given that it was so far behind its deadline before this, where is the money after this? And, you know, in terms of social determinants of health, like, the three of us have talked before about you know, the intersection between homelessness and healthcare. And so if we have FEMPI2 and another round of recessions, you know, how many more kids are going to end up in homelessness with all that impact? So, you know.
And Gabrielle, you're absolutely right there to raise the social determinants of health. I was thinking that specifically, and I know it asked you that from the outset in terms of like, not just the children in homeless, the children in direct provision, the children with special needs, yeah. Children in families who are being traumatized, losing their jobs. You know, yeah. We saw in the last recession, you know, suicide rates increased, you know, health issues, particularly amongst those who become unemployed, you know, seriously increase. You know, there's going to be huge impacts of what is ahead of us. But I can't help but be struck by, you know, in a way, you know, the Irish state and the government has done very well in some aspects, and probably the principle mostly that they said, we are going to throw everything we have at this. And, you know, in a way, you know, there hasn't been limits in terms of finance or in terms of resourcing in that sense. And the question then is, well, if we can do that now, if we say that health is our priority and that ensuring we have a healthy population and everybody can meet their capacity and we don't have the huge inequalities that we currently have, why do we not just say after this crisis is over that we will continue with that principle?
And that's the question, Rory, is that why was it that this was something where we could say there's no limit, we're just going to do what we have to do, but, you know, thousands of children being born into and living in homelessness wasn't? Because I don't see the difference, and I don't.
No, you're absolutely right, and I don't. And I think a lot of people are looking at that and saying, you know, this does raise that question. Well,
Rory,
and I think that's
Rory. Not enough people, sadly. I think what Gabrielle says really important is that post this, the way we review it and the questions we ask and the way we ask about, you know, because this. We're talking about this extreme social distancing. We're talking about, you know, how the Irish people reacted. There has been very little pushback. There's been a lot of compliance. There's been a lot of people compliant. And, you know, when you're hearing things about, you know, well, we're all doing our playing our part. Gabrielle, you're very right to point out that there was a report that sat for over 10 years gathering dust that meant that, you know, if we had been in a better position, we maybe would have been limited the economic damage, to use those terms that they're going to use, that because that's what's happening now, is all this talk is beginning to turn in the mainstream to what's the economic cost of this now. And when it starts to get to that, and we're seeing reports this morning about the €350 being too generous, you know, people, and when you hear phrases like that, you realize that this is now starting to push back and they're counting the pennies again. And when you start to count the pennies, you're right to be skeptical about, you know, what that would mean for the actual money.
When I hear that, I feel like it's the steps of breaking bad news that they're getting us ready for FEMPI2 and austerity. And so that's my big worry, because I guess, Rory, to come back to what you were saying about, you know, if we could do this now, you know, what about afterwards? You know, the way we're having to borrow now to fund this, the way we're funding it and the subsidies that we're doing, we can only do that for a couple of months before the impact on the small and medium businesses is that loads of them shut to the point where they don't have the capital, like, to open up again. So there's a limited window where we can run the country like this and come out of it. And I guess my big worry is that we head straight back into austerity again, and there's no money for anything. And so what's the story with the patients on the waiting list? What's the story with the hospital projects that are ongoing in terms of the Children's Hospital, the National Maternity Hospital moving to Vincent's? You know, there's lots of hospitals in this country that are outdated now, even just from an infection control point of view, because they don't have enough single rooms. The hallways are the old standard. You know, all those things that, you know, we've had this pandemic now that we're in. But the reality is, you know, as long as we're not acting enough on climate change and, you know, we're having humans and animals live in such proximity, this is unfortunately only the first one. And we're going to have more of these until we start living our lives differently and, you know, more in tune with nature and, you know, taking into account the things we need to do to prevent climate change, which has, again, all those impacts on health. So,
But Gabrielle, in terms of what the point was making about, though, the you know, what we're doing now in terms of, clearly in terms of supporting, you know, the general business and economy, you know, there's limits to that. But you know, you would hope that as the economy opens, of course it will, you know, things will start improving, the amount of money that will have to go to business will reduce. But on the other hand, borrowing to, for example, invest and create a public health system that meets all these targets that, you know, we should be meeting is not an unreasonable or unsustainable approach to take. You know, borrowing for investment, and this is, I think, the big argument we will have to make, because they will say that, oh, we, you know, we've done all this borrowing, so we can't borrow anymore, and we have to go back to deficit and austerity. Whereas we need to distinguish that there's a difference between borrowing and spending on investment and delivering health, housing, education, welfare supports, than just, you know, funneling money into businesses unended. There's a drastically difference.
Stephen Kinsella is very good on this, and he wrote another piece there, I think it's about 2 weeks ago, where he was talking about, you know, in the years of austerity, when capital investment just stopped, and, you know, the damage that has going forwards. I mean, if we look at our health service, the fact that when other European countries were investing a lot in capital projects in the 80s, and we were in, you know, a bad way, we're still paying the price for that, because, you know, I'm working in hospitals that have buildings that are like 150 years old, 100 years old. You don't generally see that in other countries. Like when I go to conferences and I visit hospitals, so many of their hospitals are new because they are continuously spending on capital. And it's a question of, you know, we have updated your building now, and then, you know, you're sitting on the train coming around again. And so they're in these constant cycles of investing in capital that then have them in a better position when things like this happen, because they are going to keep happening. And I totally agree, Rory, it comes back to, you know, what are our priorities? And for me, a system where everybody has their needs met within 6 weeks, that's something that's worth fighting for and striving for. But it's getting that unity of purpose and an agreement. And I think, you know, in some ways, one of the problems we have is that half the population have private health insurance. And because they can have so much elective care provided so quickly and easily and comfortably in the private sector currently, those people feel that they don't quite need as much to be investing more in the public sector. But the reality is, when they have a stroke or a heart attack or cancer, or they're in a road traffic accident, it's a really good public hospital that they're going to need to go to, because that's where the skill set is. So there's almost like a public education piece around getting people aware of, look, if we get the public system functioning really well, you actually don't need to be spending that money on your private health insurance. And actually, some of it will go into maybe more tax towards it, or towards, or into UHI, or whatever the funding model is. And some of it will actually end up back in your pocket. And, you know, there's loads of European countries that do it really well. We don't need to reinvent the wheel on this, but we do have to stop this thing we do in Ireland where we do a report and it becomes political. And so one side say, oh, that's crap because it's yours. And there's massive talk about it. And there's another report. And meanwhile, all the frontline workers are getting demoralised and wrecked working in a system that doesn't really work for patients.
Gabrielle, just on that point, I think that's almost across the board. There's unfortunately, and I shouldn't even use the term unfortunately, there is a strong cohort of people who are talking about going back to normal. And normal wasn't getting it done for enough people. It was leaving too many people behind. It really needs to be addressed as, you know, like normal. When you say how we replenish and we rebuild our capital projects, be it hospitals, be it infrastructure, that they're job creators doing all those all the time. And even during times of recession, they steady jobs, they keep things going. Secondly, when it comes to housing, if the state is implementing on housing, they maintain a good standard of, you know, that they're building 20% of the capacity every year, and that because we're facing into huge unemployment in the construction industry at the moment, and you can protect those things.
Have a quick word with it after.
So the only thing I'd say is 11. Normal is not going to get it done.
And I really hope, Tony, that the solidarity that we're seeing, where people, you know, because COVID was a threat to everyone, and I guess if we look back, probably a certain component of our society, you know, felt homelessness was never going to be an issue for them personally, whereas COVID was potentially an issue for every single man, woman and child on the island. But if we can get people looking at the healthcare system and the housing system in that sort of a, you know, that a country that is more equal and for everyone is a safer country for everyone to live in. Like, you're safer being wealthy in a country that has low inequality, you know, less crime. So you can actually appeal to people's self-interest on doing the right thing. And so we'll never go back. This has changed the Irish psyche, and it has taken away, you know, the basic fabrics of what we thought were safe and normal went overnight. Mm. And so there's an opportunity in that to say, no, we're not going back, but we're going to go forward and we're going to build something better. And the key thing is that it is something better and that it's more inclusive and there's less inequality. And one issue I have is that at the moment, any feedback that is anyways negative is seen as not donning the green jersey. And that's all that is actually just trying to stifle discussion that's really needed, because in any situation like this that's really dynamic and you're making decisions in real time, you're going to make mistakes, because if you wait until you're sure it's perfect, you've missed the boat, and actually that's worse.
Mm.
So we have to be having that 10th man concept that myself and Roy were talking about offline, where you have people in the room going, no, hold on. Okay, I know we're looking like we're going that direction, but are we sure about that? Let's actually just flip this on its head and look at the other thing. We need to be open to being constantly questioning our direction, so that if we're going in the wrong direction, we just readjust. And it comes back almost to our toxic blame culture and the way our political system is, where we have two almost identical parties fighting with each other for relevance and control. And we have to start moving away from that and towards one of
Couldn't agree more.
I couldn't agree more.
The ability to question and transparency and accountability is so important. And the idea that any of this can be politicized as a game is just toxic to the actual democracy.
Civil liberties are really important. And, you know, things that are given up aren't always gotten back straight away, depending on who's in power. So it is important that people are really questioning all these things and ensuring that they're done in a way that's constitutional and fair and equitable. And I guess I really dislike some of the thinly veiled like political action of shutting down debate and discussion, because that is really bad.
You're absolutely right, Gabrielle, and it's something that the Irish state is notorious for doing, and it's not just government. It's we've had decades and generations of politicians and governments and state agencies and state bodies that have shut down critical thinking. And there's a real fear. And I think it goes back to the foundation of the state that was founded on a civil war and founded on difference, but founded on a deep insecurity and conservatism. That goes back to the role of the Catholic Church and everything in the state, that it was, this idea that we don't have, and it's still a big issue, people who are in the, like ourselves, who are in the public sphere, who are, not exactly towing the line and, not even not towing the line, but just offering critical observations and critical assessments and, saying, questioning, as you're saying, that there's this, unbelievable negative reaction from the very top. And, and I've experienced it in housing, from the Taoiseach, and, we've seen it, others as well have experienced it, academics who've spoken out, that there's this kind of, as you say, a groupthink, which of course leads us into these constant crisis situations. But there is a real sense that, and it goes through the media as well, this idea that if you're anyway questioning, that you're somehow not, on board with what we're doing. And this real, it's a deep insecurity.
Your question in those, you're subversive and it's not safe to give you a seat at the table, as opposed to actually you're massively needed at the table, because these questions will help us carve out.
And not just at the table, but in the public sphere. Like, it's this real thing of don't talk about that publicly. Do you know what I mean? We can't really debate that publicly. We know this is going on, but we don't really want to debate it, because there's, this sense that if we're questioned, then we're somehow, we're not doing a good job, or we're not, and there's not an ability to actually have a discussion in the public sphere or amongst people, where if you're criticized or you disagree, that doesn't mean you're wrong or you're being attacked, or that actually you need this to have a healthy system, to have a healthy society, a healthy democracy.
It's almost like it's a very rigid way of like black and white, right or wrong, when the reality for me is that I spend a lot of my professional life working in grey areas where the answer actually isn't clear, and there's pros and cons, and there's merit to Tony's idea and there's merit to your idea, and there'll be overlap where you're both in agreement and it's right, and there'll be things that maybe you might be very opposed on, but actually both of them could work. There's more than one way to skin a cat, and I think it's sort of opening people's mind to, you can disagree with people on things, you can actually both be right and have a valid perspective, and it doesn't mean you know, Tony's not a patriot because he doesn't agree with this, you know, this kind of Tony's not wearing the green jersey because his perspective is different, or God forbid, Tony has a different lived experience. So his views on something are still valid of the exact same thing, even though they're different from yours. And it's that not tolerating the gray area that I think is something we have to work on, because it only costs us in the end, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you've been a really important voice in you know, raising these issues, Gabrielle. And, you know, keep at it. We're, you know, we're really behind you and supporting you. And, you know, the vision that you've set out, I think, is really so important. The idea of the waiting list, the idea of Sláintecare Care, you know, the public health system, you know, 6 weeks. It is brilliant. And please keep plugging away at it. We're all behind you. And all your colleagues, you know, who are doing amazing on the front line. And it really does show.
Proud of them, Rory, like, especially like my ICU colleagues. You know, I have a friend whose husband is on immune suppression, and so she's actually living away from him and their kids at the moment because she's
It's incredible.
Patients in the ICU. Like, I can't think of anything more patriotic or any more sacrifice than that. You know, it's just incredible. Like,
yeah, and the whole thing is, you know, this is the ultimate. You know, showing that Thatcher's idea that there was no such thing as society, and neoliberals' idea that everyone's just out for themselves, is so wrong, that actually people really want to work for society to ensure we have a good society, people are well. And that's the type of, you know, systems we need to promote. So thank you so much.
I think for lots
Gabrielle, do you want to keep going?
No, I was just going to say, like, it's kind of, it's connection that drives us all, that sense of, like, you know, giving something to others and being part of something that's bigger than ourselves, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
I just want to say, in terms of, yeah, we're all in this together. It really helped if you go over and be in this together to patreon.com/tortoiseshack and gave us the price of a cup of coffee.
Very good.
Gabrielle, thanks so much for talking to us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. The pleasure is always.